Dudley, the LS Gamekeeper Tractor Giveaway. It's happening. August 31st is the deadline. Somebody's going to win this thing.
And they're going to get a nice unit.
I wish we could figure out a way to not give it away because no, I have enjoyed using it so much.
Yeah, it's got a belly mower. It's got a bucket on the front. It's got a bucket on the back.
Yep, and there's a tiller attachment that goes with it. So it's a very handy tractor around the camp house. So go to mossyoakgamekeeper.com/giveaway and you can sign up. Seriously, August 31st, somebody's going
to
win it.
I can't wait to tell all my buddies about it. Hopefully I can use it again if one of my friends wins it.
Hi, I'm Jeff Foxworthy and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We're live in 3, 2, 1.
All right, well, welcome everybody to West Point, Mississippi, home of Mossy Oak brand camo and the Gamekeeper studio, and we got a wild crowd today.
Everybody's kind of amped up today. It's getting that time of year, holiday season. It's a hunting season more than
pouting. Anything. It's called pouting.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so Bobby calls class at 2 p.m. close to the peak of our rut. Yeah. Great job, Bobby. Great job.
And Vandy is the only one hunting.
Well, I keep hearing
in my spot, no doubt. Well, because I think even Bobby did the bait switch on me.
That's a good idea.
No.
Who's going to answer the phones?
Yeah, well, you know, Vandy can be missing and it doesn't really change much.
All right, so Vandy's cell number is...
Yeah, there you go.
I don't think it rings much during the rut.
No. Well, somebody saw a buck chasing last
couple of days.
I've seen them for a week, you know. Behind my house, between here and work, out on the farm, they're...
Yeah. Well, I mean, bucks chase,
You've lived here all your life. What's the best days? Is it?
That's a tough question. The last time we did like a health check, they had the range between December 5th and January 5th here. So, but I would say the only thing I've always said is like by the 10th, it's for sure on in some form. If you're like, you know, and I know weather and other things can, you know, make movement, and movement is everything. So I would say peak would be right, you know, maybe another week from now. The good doctor will know better than me scientifically. But I would also say I tend to see the really big older deer start to amp up, seeing pictures and back of trucks and stuff right around Christmas as it goes down. And I feel like it's because they've had a doe, they've been on a doe or they've been with a doe almost constantly for maybe 2 weeks. And all of a sudden, it's not that easy to find one.
So they got,
and they're worn down. On top of that, their senses are a little bit numb, and they just start walking a lot more. And they're a lot easier to catch one moving then than when they're on a doe. So I don't know. It seems like around Christmas is where, after lockdown.
Yeah,
after lockdown,
starting to post.
They can't. But those old deer are most vulnerable to me. Is like when they finally can't find one.
It's like a bell-shaped curve to me. You know, there's this doe population. He's breeding through it, and when it starts tapering off, he's going to start looking. Kind of like you, Bobby, back in the day. You know,
but anytime
trying to secure that breeding opportunity. You know,
anytime we're in the breeding season or the rut, though, you've got a shot at being on a terrific hunt. You know, because I've seen it when it was in the peak, and that's really not that good sometimes. But there'd be like 6 or 7 bucks on one doe, and that's chaos, and that's a fun hunt.
Remember that year in front of the Mossy Oak store when that it's like a 3-year-old 10-point was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 days in a row.
He was running
around out in front of the Mossy Oak store.
I think
that was around the 12th or something like that.
Yeah, and this time of year, almost every year you'll get I saw one in Old Brian Foods front yard right here in town the other day going home with like a 2-year-old 8 or 9 point. But you'll have a report if someone ran through a window of a store in downtown or somebody saw one chasing a doe well inside the city limits. As always, this time of year, you get the crazy stories. They crashed through downtown Columbus before, downtown Starville, downtown West Point, downtown Aberdeen. I know Phil Barker's father-in-law opened the paint store one morning and a huge 8-point came crashing out over him out the door and had torn the Sherwin-Williams store to shred. So it always happens this time of year.
Yeah, and according to my windshield rut report, you know, I drive 20 miles every day to work. The roads are full of dead deer.
I've noticed that,
yes,
too.
Yes,
yeah. Just like flipping a switch.
Mm-hmm. A lot of them are spikes.
Well, that'd be part of the discussion we're fixing to have, too.
That's right. So today we've got Dr. Steve Damaris from Mississippi State University.
Yes, the good doctor.
Sound the horns.
There we go. We got
sometimes it gets on my nerves, Bobby, but today he's worth it.
Yeah. He and Bronson are just, yes, they're both brilliant guys. They've got their own podcast called Deer University that's full of information. I highly recommend
it. Well, there's also an old saying my daddy has that's appropriate to both of them, especially him, is that this ain't their first rodeo.
No, they've been around
a long time.
So we've got a bunch of good questions to ask about managing for a healthy population. How do you know how many deer you need to take off your property, and looking for ways to know that you've got a potential problem. So, we're going to get to that. I got a few business things we need to tidy up first. And one of the first things we always talk about is blood on the biologic.
Oh, yeah.
What's everybody seeing?
I'm not seeing anything. I'm hearing about a lot of things.
Well, you're not a social media guy.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, so
socially challenged.
Harper May. Now, she's friends with David Holly. Killed her first buck the other day. It was a great little picture. I think she's 10 years old.
Wow.
I love seeing these
youngins get out. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff we want to bring attention to. Yeah. That's really cool.
It seems like we get more and more kids every week and fewer older people because we enjoy hearing about that more.
Yeah, we pick them out for sure.
Absolutely.
The one I picked was a longtime customer of mine, Travis Slezak, up in Pennsylvania. He calls me and gives me a report on his trees from time to time. Both of his boys have already gotten a deer this year. And he posted it on Instagram. One of them's name is Mason, and I didn't get the other one's name, but congrats to both of them.
Yeah. Well, good deal.
Yep.
And then our very own Jody Robinson's son, Henry Jonas, is his dad. They were successful this morning. He's a future little gamekeeper out there. Killed him a nice, nice buck this morning.
Is that so right? He's young, too.
He is young, yeah. Henry Robinson. So I think that's going to get Hayden all fired up for this weekend.
I do think the boys killed a couple of nice deer in that Texas hunt.
Oh, that's right.
Oh,
Jess,
yeah.
And Daniel killed some deer.
But that's different. That's not.
Vatoville.
I have not seen any pictures. So.
Yeah, that was Tim Ashton's
place. You know, we got some.
Rest in peace, Tim.
We got some little trees from Vatoville that Tim Anderson gave us the acorns
sure
to.
Sure did.
Years
I forgot
ago,
about so. That. Wow.
Hopefully they're going to be in the catalog soon.
That'd be awesome.
Vatoville Oaks.
How about that? Yeah, well, hey, the Henry Robinson.
Yeah.
So he killed that this morning?
I believe so. I got the picture today. So
okay, good for him. That's exciting. His mother is a really sweet person.
Yeah, absolutely. His great family. Great family from here in West Point. Jody here works here. His wife works here, and they're big brand people. So congratulations to all them.
Yeah, that is good. So, Dudley, to change the subject a little bit, I hear there's some project you've been working on. Do you want to tell us about that?
Oh, are we going to talk about that today?
We can.
Well,
is this another food plot planning method? Who are we calling?
Let's see if I can pull it up.
There's Mac. Okay, Mac. So,
what are we talking about? Food plots?
Well, I don't know. I just heard Dudley's been working on a project.
Species of tree.
So, you know, I'm a big fan of Christmas.
Yeah.
And I was in the choir in high school.
Oh, really? I didn't know this.
So,
did you sing bass or tenor?
Actually, I was a baritone.
A baritone.
I think he was in a boy band.
I'm all about the Christmas spirit. We've been talking about doing this for years. I've been wanting to sing at our annual Christmas party, maybe make a quartet or something.
Hey, you should get with Tony Marshall and his kids. They really do it.
Anyway, we've been putting together a little fun Christmas album.
Awesome. Who has?
Don't you have? Break the... Just make them wonder.
So, what are we going to get to hear a cut off of it today or something?
Dudley, I'd plead the fifth. I wouldn't tell Bobby a thing. I'd make him just have to wonder about it.
Bring us a sample?
I think Mac's got a couple of samples for my new Christmas album.
All right, Mac.
Here we go. This is Dudley Phelps.
No way.
Merry Christmas.
For the first time ever, you can hear the Dudley Phelps Christmas album with songs like It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. toys in every store.
Is this
a beautiful rendition of chestnuts roasting over an open fire?
Is this blight resistant chestnuts?
But the prettiest sight to see is the holly that will be on your own front door.
It's kind of got a Sinatra feel to it.
And Grandma got run over by a reindeer.
Grandma got run over by a reindeer. Walking home from our house Christmas Eve. You can say there's no such thing as Santa, but as for me and Grandpa, we believe!
Man.
This is an opportunity you don't want to miss. Available now for pre-order.
Oh my gosh, the iTunes chart.
Yeah. It's going to light it up. Yeah. I mean, this
I don't know what to say.
Hopefully in a couple weeks you can find this on Spotify, iTunes.
I never knew you had such a soothing Christmas voice.
Yeah.
Wow.
Do you call that soothing?
Well, you know. It's more soothing than mine.
That could keep the pigs out of your plot.
Face as red as it feels like?
Yeah, okay. Pretty much.
Yeah.
So were those blight-resistant chestnuts?
I'm impressed with your
courage. Those were blight-resistant chestnuts.
Oh, no. Yeah. Good.
Your courage, man. Yeah. I'm telling you, I'm impressed.
That did take courage. Dr. Steve, I'm sorry you had to sit through all that.
How can I possibly follow that?
Yeah, it's going to be tough.
I noticed you kind of pulled his headphones away from his ears a little bit.
Yes, he did. He did. So, look, Mac, last thing. So, let's get back serious here.
Oh, man.
Have you prepared a commercial for us real quick?
What are we talking about today, Mac?
You know what time it is, Bobby?
You know what I do? It's 2:20, but looking at my Bertucci.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about is the Gamekeeper Edition Bertucci watch. I mean, it's durable. It's camouflage, comes in bottomland. I mean, it's got a lot of different styles. It's really good, super reliable, and I absolutely love mine.
It's a great watch. I mean, I think we all have one, but they are fantastic watches. And, Dr. Steve, we've got you one
today.
As a guest for being on the show, driving all the way over here, we've got you a Bertucci Gamekeeper watch.
I really appreciate that, Bobby.
Yeah, they're great watches. You'll enjoy wearing it. Thank you, Mac, and we appreciate the people that you can go see it at Bertucci.com.
I love mine.
All right, so we got all the business out of the way. Let's get down to some serious stuff with Dr. Steve here and ask you some questions. We mentioned earlier we want to talk about a healthy herd and what a guy needs to do, but we hear – I guess let's open it up and talk about the populations across the South and then move north. Because most of the places we hear about having too many deer, but there are places where that might not be the case. Is that right?
Well, there are almost always too many deer, but the number of deer is always going to be an issue with one side or the other, and there's two sides to this issue. Our perspective is from the hunter, and my personal perspective is as a biologist, so I think about the health of the deer and the health of the habitat more than, what I want to see when I go out and hunt. But there's always somebody complaining about too many or too few deer. And typically at the end of the hunting season, we hear a lot from hunters say, I didn't see enough deer this year. And so the number of deer is always an issue, and coming up with a decent estimate is really, really challenging. It's extremely challenging. So these, state agencies have to come up with numbers, and they do the best job with the available technology that they have and the databases that they have. But a lot of the times, these numbers you see in magazines are just kind of ballpark figures. Mm. Mississippi has had an estimate of 1.5 to 2 million deer. That was generated back in the 1980s. From a population reconstruction based on early harvest data. And we still say we have about 1.5 to 2 million deer. And there's no data to show that we don't have that many deer. But it's so, Toxie can talk about how many deer he sees in his backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he doesn't know how many deer is on his farm.
And they may, I'll tell you what, there's a couple of things he alluded to there. One, I would say is, and I would love for him to back up everything I say, or not, but how many deer you're seeing and what your population is can easily be two different things. So that's one thing. I mean, because I know we hunt places that have too many deer, and we still, the thing about it, if you're not careful and you do things and pattern. You know, if you're not careful about how you go about your hunts, those deer, as we always say, they'll pattern you
right,
like we're getting to a pattern them. And so you can't just go by just sighting it. I think the trail camera probably has more to do with helping than anything. But I'd like for him to allude, before I talk about any other or have questions, like what are some of the signs other than just like numbers you see?
Right.
That can be an indicator.
That's right.
And then I will say one other complication in our part of the world that's just so frustrating is that combine that with the effect of all this unbelievable rise in the number of wild hogs. Because just browse pressure on stuff at ground level, you can't tell anymore. Not unless you put cameras up. You really can't tell what's destroyed, you know, food sources. Really. Now, I guess the browse lines are a good one.
That's an absolute – that's one of our take-it-to-the-bank
right.
methods, especially for biologists. Most state biologists, they spend maybe a day on a property or an afternoon on a property at best because they're working with, you know, 100, 150 properties. And they may get out and be able to check through the property as best they can, but looking at the plants, they're always there. And so we look at the relative browse pressure and – not just of green stuff, because everything that's green in the summertime and everything that's just woody and partially green in the wintertime, it's not all deer food. And so we have to understand what we're looking at and the species of plants and for your region, what species of plants are preferred and which are not. And then you look at the browse pressure on those plants. And a lot of times you don't see the highly preferred forages at all on properties because they've been eaten those highly preferred forages for 50, 60 years since deer were, you know, restored effectively by our state wildlife agency.
Like a strawberry bush, for example. I mean, a lot of people never have seen it in the wild.
That's classic.
Yeah.
I've
seen it two places, one on a really steep creek
bank
and then one in an enclosed area.
So if you got a lot of strawberry bush, you don't have very many deer.
So you're looking at those those ones that they don't prefer that much and seeing how much of that is there.
Well, I hope I don't even get down to the not preferred forages. I'm looking at those, what I like to call is important deer forages that may or may not be highly preferred, but they're important to the deer and the health of the deer. And so things like greenbrier is a really important deer forage because it's not green all year round, but it's green much of the year. The leaves are almost perennial. And so deer can forage on the leaves and they'll forage on the stems as well. And it's also widely distributed. So a biologist can just about anywhere in the Southeast go out and look at relative browse pressure on smilax and tell a lot about that property's deer population. Mm. And in most cases I've looked at, you'll see barely leaves, just stems at this time of year.
I remember seeing some the other day. I'm a public land hunting nerd, and I mean, I hunt private too, but that's one of the first things to look for when you're on public and there's no food plots or anything like that. That smilax.
I killed a pretty good deer once, and the browse line about head high, maybe a little less, was so just complete. Nothing was there. And then there was just a big ball of it, probably 20 by 30 feet above that, out from an old dead cedar that had just built up in there. And it was all that stuff. So I clipped it where it fell over on the ground. And the next day you could see tracks all around. They were feeding on that. And I killed a deer over it. It's pretty cool. But they loved it. But also could tell you there was too many deer where I was hunting. It was at the cotton mill, actually.
Okay.
And I've asked a lot of biologists, state biologists, and here in our state, Mississippi, how of the properties you visit, and they visit literally hundreds, what percentage are in good condition habitat-wise? And they said less than 5% typically. Mm-hmm. When they go out to a new property, they're going to be in good condition.
Wow.
And I mean, double that with it, what kind of habitats there to start with. I mean, you get a place where almost no sunlight hits the ground, you got big problems. Now, you could have a fresh cutover or, you know, some land that's actually, I think you would say, abandoned land of some type, not necessarily crop land, although some of that can be great forage for a part of the year, or especially not heavily timbered canopied land, but that, you know, select cut, randomly cut, grown-up edge pasture stuff, that's got a chance to have some year-round food in it, and it's really, really important. And so the more that you have, the more you would have stuff survive that you need for your deer. But if you don't have that kind of stuff, because I'm thinking about me, it's the places I really, really need to cut some timber. And if I don't hurry up and do it, you know, it's, I mean, the amount of deer is so much more important there than a place with excess food is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, they migrate. As y'all remember, Jordan's famous giant deer he killed with a bow here. We had pictures of that deer on Daddy's farm, mm-hmm. 2.25 miles from there in the summer, all summer long. And then all of a sudden, boom, 1st of November, he's 2.5 miles away on the swamp chestnuts. They'll move for food. And once they know, it's amazing how far they'll move. We have pictures of deer. Our one neighbor, who's a great neighbor out there at the cabin, and I don't remember a big deer he's killed in the last, 10 years or so. They've showed us that we didn't have pictures at the cabin right there because we've got all that open ground there, and they come for the summer, and we've finally got a lot of clover and stuff there. Mm. And, you know, they'll be a mile plus away, you know.
Well, y'all been doing some studies, and there's been a couple of bucks that have traveled a really long way.
Oh, yeah. We've documented personalities of deer, we call it. It's, you know, it's not like a human personality per se, but there's characteristics of an animal's behavior. And we see two basic personalities. One is what we call the sedentary buck, and he lives in a single home range. There might be 2 or 3 miles across that home range, but he's going to stay in a single home range and then make exploratory sallies or short trips during the breeding season looking for does. But they're sedentary. They live in one basic place. And then we call the mobile bucks, another third of the population, literally a third of all the bucks we've studied are mobile bucks. They live in 2 or more home ranges.
Wow.
And one of our extreme cases on steroids, this hasn't been written up yet much because we just documented it recently, but we have a buck that we captured in the South Mississippi Delta down Issaquena County, north of Vicksburg. And he spent, we captured him in, I can't remember all the details, but he spent the summer in Louisiana, swam to Louisiana after we collared him, and then came back this past August. So he was in Mississippi last winter.
Wow.
Last spring, he left and went to Louisiana, swam the river, and then came back in August.
What? Yeah. This is crazy.
That's a big river right there.
Oh, yeah. It's a huge river. And he went to food. He was living in a place where there's a lot of soybeans.
So now, do you think it is food that's causing that?
Well, there's a – boy, we could
– how would he know?
We need a whole separate podcast to talk about why deer move, and it would be great. I'd be happy to come over and talk
about that. Put that in the notes.
Yeah, I will.
I'm thinking he spent falls and winters in Mississippi because he knew something about the deer hunters in Louisiana.
Hey, that thing.
I didn't say it.
He said it. I didn't say it.
But we do go and catch all their trout and redfish, so it's justified.
They have a few extras.
They do. You know, the big picture point of what he's saying, though, is like, I was thinking to myself, how does that deer know? I mean, how did he even know that there was food? I mean, I know what their noses are like, but 2 miles, 3 miles away across the river or something, I don't. And the answer to a lot of this stuff sometimes is like nature is just amazing.
That's right.
Just mind-boggling amazing. The instincts and the survival and the, you know, all of this stuff we talk about is all on the same plane of like, you know, survival and adaptation, and, you know, it's crazy. Plants, animals, everything. It's just amazing to watch nature at work and all this stuff. It's why I love it so much.
And one of the reasons I think, and we're not supposed to talk about this time, but movement is characteristically ingrained into deer. They have to move. Mm-hmm. And not all the deer need to be these long-range mobile bucks, because anytime a deer is out across the landscape, he's at risk. And so deer generally want to avoid risk, which goes back to Toxie's comment mm-hmm. about, you know, you can overhunt and not see deer. And Dudley's talked about it earlier, too. And a percentage of deer need to move for the basis and the benefit of the population and the species.
Right.
And they need to know what's out there so that when things get tough, they can go and get what they need. And so that's why only a third, I think, of these mobile bucks are mobile, because they're at risk. And so the population doesn't need to invest in all of the deer doing this, but some somewhat less intelligent ones, maybe. You know, just more risk takers. Right. The people that are on cutting edge, and absolutely forget the part about the intelligent people. Think back about, you know, Toxie, when you started this company, you were a risk taker.
Yeah.
And you decided to take a risk, and look what's happened.
Yeah.
And so risk is risky, and there's oftentimes negative effects from it. And boy, I'm rambling into this.
No, okay, I'm real excited too. I like to interject also. He talked about me being a risk taker, but it helps a lot to be real naive.
To his previous comments.
Yeah, so you're saying a third of them are sedentary. A third of them are...
Two-thirds are sedentary. One-third are mobile.
Okay.
So, and help us understand, sedentary is living within a mile, and then a mobile is living within 3 or 4 miles?
Totally different home ranges. They have seasonal home ranges. A mobile buck will live like the one in Mississippi and Louisiana.
A completely separate place.
They live in a totally separate place, and it can be separated by a couple of miles or, you know, an entire Mississippi River. We had another buck in Yazoo and Madison County. He lived in Madison County, and in August, we collared him in August, and then the very next day he left. And we thought, oh, man, we affected his personality. You know, we made him nervous. He left. He didn't like what we did to him. He moved 13 miles away and spent the fall and winter, and then in the following February he came back.
13 miles.
13 miles. And then he spent, again, 6 months where we had captured him. The following August, he left again within a week of the same time.
Wow. That you collared him.
Yeah, I've seen a bunch of trail cam pictures of that deer.
That's
extremely
different.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
And back to, you know, Toxie talking about, you know, they're so cool and the ecology of the animals. I mean.
Yeah. I remember the early studies on hens and radioed hens and whatever when I grew up down there around all that. And biologist from Auburn was doing those early studies, and there was a hen went 7 miles every spring and nested within 50 yards of the exact same spot, and then came back and to the exact same place every winter too.
Wow.
And I don't know why that was the case or why she traveled there. I was going to ask you, are there any deer? I know you say the sedentary versus the movers. Are there any deer that are almost like hogs, coyotes, don't have a home? They just kind of roam, or do they all seem to have a homing device as they circulate back around to where they were, where it's home?
They all have highly used areas.
Right, okay.
Yeah, they're all going to be. And even those sedentary bucks, they're going to be shifting, like you were talking about, you know, shifting associated with food supply. Mm-hmm. They're in the soybean fields until they're harvested, and then they're going into the oaks, the white oaks, and then later the red oaks. And
yes, we'll go down this rabbit hole and not even talk about your topic, Bobby, but the one other thing. Is true. They've determined that a year and a half old deer that is comes into the, you know, the breeding cycle and mom goes in heat, there's a repellent that goes on that he will get out of the country where his mom is. It's almost like a prevent inbreeding type of thing with deer. So in a lot of cases they'll move to a whole nother area to get away from mom. Does she
run them off? Or
well, there's two times when deer disperse. One is right around 1 year of age, about 11 months of age, when that doe is in her late stage of gestation, and she doesn't want to mess with that
pony anymore. Yeah,
that young buck from the last. Quit bothering me.
Right,
you know, go to your room, and she just kicks that fawn out of her family unit. And he'll hang around. And a lot of times early in the deer season, you'll see a doe, a family unit doe and a fawn and maybe a yearling doe from the previous year on a food plot. And this yearling buck kind of 100 yards away, kind of
right,
just there by himself. And that could be her fawn from the previous year. So he got kicked away, but he didn't get all the way. But there's usually this burst of dispersal, and it's what we call as a dispersal, is a one-time movement away from where they were bred, where they're fawned. And then the second pulse of dispersal is in the fall, and that's when they're getting kicked around by their older bucks, and they have a second dispersal.
Interesting.
It is fascinating. So when you come back, when we hear about this habitat being in such poor condition, is the big challenge to shoot enough, to harvest enough does, harvest enough total deer off your property? Is that what we need to be doing?
It's really complex, Bobby, and it's a lot of factors. It's the number of mouths eating the food, but it's also the amount of food being produced.
Yes.
And if you don't have canopy open on in your forests, you're not going to have sunshine on the ground. If you don't have sunshine reaching the ground, you're not going to produce food.
Yep. So, for example, my farm in central Mississippi, we can't get anybody to thin the pines. And so my habitat has deteriorated tremendously.
Yes.
And so it's even more important to take more mouths out because there's no food around. There's little cover, too.
Timber market is a really limitation to deer management right now.
But when I'm able to get that thinned and I start having more food around, I can probably back off a little bit and see more deer when I'm hunting. Well, right.
I was talking with a landowner in Bottomland Hardwoods along the Mississippi River this past fall, and they were complaining, well, we're only going to get $100 an acre on this timber harvest we've got going. I said, at least you're not having to pay them to harvest your timber.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They're interested in deer management, and if you don't get sunlight on the ground, you're not going to have forage.
Right.
So it's a cost of doing business right now. You have to take what you can get for your timber just to get it on the ground and open some sunlight.
Hey, this is Mac. Checking game cameras is one of the many pleasures I get from gamekeeping. OnX helps keep track of my camera locations to be sure I'm getting the information that I need to make the best decisions for the wildlife. Try it out for yourself and see. Use coupon code MOSSYOAK to save 20% on your OnX subscriptions. Know where you stand.
So is there any formulas that a guy can apply to his own personal property to know how many deer he needs to harvest?
No.
That's a tough one.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
I mean, I know I'm asking a kind of a dumb question, but I'm just trying to see if there's some way we can help our listeners.
Some kind of rule of thumb.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of rules of thumb that apply in many areas of deer of many locations where deer are managed. One of them is the 30% rule. And if you have good quality habitat, you should be harvesting 30% of your doe population every year just to keep it at a given level.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to decrease the number of deer, just to keep it in a healthy condition at a reasonable density.
You know, when you think about the number, that's a lot of deer.
I like that.
It's a lot of work.
Think about someone who has failed to do that for like 10 years.
Yeah,
and then you've got something where
it's exponential.
You might need to get 60 or 70% of them or something. I mean, who knows? It's tough. It's really tough. And then, how big is your place? Can you really make an impact if you have 200 acres to hunt? And
what are your neighbors doing?
Surrounded by 2,000 that won't shoot their deer. I mean,
right.
So, I mean, I think the word I get out to people is like harvest is many. I mean, unless you just don't have any, you don't think you have any deer and you don't have any issues with the, harvest. The native food, when you plant a food plot, is tall and lush and you don't see a lot of deer in. I mean, you have to know if you spend much time on it, if you've got very few deer, but unless you have very few deer, harvest those. And I don't live by this. I need to listen to myself too. Harvest them earlier in the deer season and shoot as many mature does as you can, really, honestly. Or, maybe there's a buck that's gotten old and he still only has like 6 points or whatever you want to do, call it. But taking mouths off is the responsible thing to do for the health of the deer. There's just absolutely no question about it.
And we all love to eat venison.
So yes, yeah, absolutely. Do.
But we're also busy. It can be hard to get out in the woods and accomplish that some years.
And it is a lot of work, especially when you're doing it on that scale.
Yeah.
We've done it.
I would encourage people to it also greatly can decrease the quality of your hunting for, a trophy and all that of mature buck.
Sure.
If you're just nipping at the deer all the time, I would say that's another big thing. It's like not just what you harvest, but how. So I've known people that had commercial lodges and had tough time, and they banned anybody harvesting does populations in the afternoon at a food source, like a grain field and stuff. Mm-hmm. No afternoon, you do it in the morning, you do it off in the, on a trail or in the woods or in a thicket, and that's fine. And they said within a year, they started seeing a lot more deer and their hunters saw a lot more deer. So I think there's a that's another thing you might could shed some light on too, is that there's a way to go about it. I would personally encourage you to get, if you really know you've got a problem, is go ahead and engage like a bunch of friends that you trust, and like when deer season opens, hit them one time, boom, you know, have a plan on it to kill 10, 8, 6, 20, whatever. And people you know that you trust, all that, and hit them, boom, boom, a day or two, and do most of your damage right away and not just nip at them all the time.
Makes sense.
The quality of hunting will be much better.
And I'm sure there's different opinions on that. You know, we used to try to take them out real early.
Absolutely.
Some people like to wait till that, you know, last few weeks of the season when the rut's over and do – I mean, I guess – and Steve, I don't know if there's a best way, but I think just getting them out is good.
That's why you don't wait to
till the last
do minute. The heavy work until the end of the day. You try to get that stuff done in the early morning when you're pumped up and you got energy.
Yeah.
You know, in Mississippi, late January, you don't feel like going out and hunting.
Yeah.
Well, plus, you end up tracking stuff at night. Into the wee hours sometimes.
Yeah, that you were talking about how outfitters have a trick. Mm-hmm. At my farm, one rule we frequently do is we don't let people shoot does in our bigger destination food plots.
Absolutely.
We do it in the, like you said, the first week of the season, and then we wait until the rut's over. But you can shoot does anywhere else, and it helps encourage people to back off from the fields.
Yes,
anyway.
Absolutely.
Hunt trails, hunt the woods, hunt the perimeters of your property to accomplish that without boogering your place up.
States have really effective DMAP regulations, where if you're working with a state DMAP biologist and you have DMAP tags, and say, I think it's Arkansas that has a law, a regulation that if you have DMAP tags for does, you can use any weapon as early as the archery season.
Yes.
Just for that targeted job. And so they have all of their members come out the first weekend in archery season, right. and they slaughter the does, and they get it done. And then during the breeding season, they're hunting bucks, not
does. Every state's different. I'm not trying to get into politics, but that would be ideal for the health of the herd. And honestly, it's going to – I've witnessed this because I've been many years of messing with them. You will see an incredible difference in the rut and the buck movement.
Yep.
That year, if you take them out before that. No question about it.
Fewer ladies.
Oh, it's amazing difference it makes.
And some guys will argue, I want to wait and I want all the does on my place. Mm-mm. So that everybody else's bucks will come here. But that's not the effective way. The better way is to get them off early when you can, and then enjoy the breeding season.
You know what? That guy can take all his does out the beginning of the season. He can accomplish the same thing. If he has a bunch of quality food plots, he's going to just have some more back in there, and he's reduced the population. If he's got those quality food sources, mm-hmm. you know, better than your neighbors and whatnot, yeah. You're going to have the does in there during the rut too. So. I mean, that's not a good excuse.
No.
Yeah. So is there if you've got multiple does out in the field, is there one that you're looking at to go, well, that's going to be the one I take out this afternoon? Is there some criteria you look for?
Yeah. Well, let me talk about what hunters look for. And a lot of times hunters say, well, I'm going to shoot the old barren doe. Well, just because she doesn't have fawns with her in the food plot doesn't mean she didn't produce fawns. She might have just lost them. And so what you end up doing is biasing the sample that the biologists are going to use to look at lactation rate. And that's a real problem with limiting condition evaluation back to the health topic.
Yeah.
And we want to look at recruitment rate. And one of the ways we do that is looking at lactation rate. And so lactation rate is a sample of a random sample, hopefully, of does and whether or not they're lactating when they're harvested. So we don't want that doe to be harvested, and they also look for the old doe instead of the younger doe. Well, the older doe is probably their best mama, so I say shoot the younger does, the yearling doe or the 2-year-old doe that's not as good of a mother, and leave the older does. But my friend Carl Miller from University of Georgia used to say, you know, if it's brown, it goes down when it comes to doe harvest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the main thing is to get does off the ground, you know, on the ground, yep. off of the population.
Yeah. Don't overthink it. Yep.
So let's add one more layer of complexity. Coyotes, because if I remember right, our buddies at Bent Creek engaged Auburn to study, and they found they were losing, this was about 10 years ago, they were losing 70% of their fawns to coyotes. They'd gotten so bad. Of course, they have a vast area. It's all timber company land, a lot of clear cuts, a lot of thickets. They never really shot any predators down there and all. And they did after that, and they saw a difference. But they were losing 70% of their fawns to coyotes. So when you add that in, then there's another factor. I have had places, and my personal opinion is I'm kind of like Glenn Garner, who I think highly of on deer management especially. He said he takes out all the coyotes he can. I'd rather make the choice on what we take out and not the coyotes, because there's very little that will push your deer movement down like having a high coyote population. I mean, they just almost don't want to move anymore too. So, but having said that, they can really knock your population back. And you can not even be shooting many deer, and you still don't have any population increase. They're getting so many of them. So what have you seen on that within the Southeast?
Well, Lanny, what's our favorite word, Bronson and I, when we talk about stuff?
Usually it's banana pudding.
It depends.
Yeah.
Predator right. control is so dependent on local circumstances. We looked at a study of, 15 properties in Alabama and Mississippi. It may have even been up to 20. We documented predator populations and fawn recruitment on all these properties two different years. And if you looked at all of those properties, there was absolutely no relationship between the number of predators on the property in the summertime and the fawn recruitment. Absolutely none. 0% predictive or relationship. Wow. Now, if you cherry pick, and oftentimes we hear a lot about, you know, the high mortality rates from coyotes on a particular place. Well, that's like cherry picking data. And oftentimes they spend money where there's a problem and then they find the problem. But if you look at properties across the states of Mississippi and Alabama like we did, we found some that, yes, there was a clear relationship between the number of predators in the summertime and lower fawn crop. But we could also cherry pick the same number of properties and different properties, but the same number, we'd have just as many where there would actually be a positive relationship between the number of predators in the summer and the fawn recruitment.
Mm. So would you think it would have to do with
habitat,
like,
maybe?
Well, I mean, what else is available to eat? Is a fawn at the top of the food chain, or I'm just guessing,
right.
But there's lots and lots of like rabbits and stuff like that, rats and all that kind of stuff. They don't get nearly as many fawns. Probably takes a little more work, except when they first drop. And so it probably has a lot to, just like anything else, what deer eat are based on preferences and what's available, and coyotes probably too.
Coyotes are lazy.
They want to spend as little as possible and get as much as possible.
Yeah. So the better quality habitat, I heard somebody said habitat, mm-hmm. and that's what it comes down to, in my opinion, is that if you have good quality fawning habitat across your property.
Same as turkeys.
And not just on little strips along SMZs. And, you know, an SMZ can have really great fawning habitat. But if that's the only habitat on your property, guess where the coyotes are going to go? And they got this right. narrow range of habitat to zip back and forth and find your fawns. So spread your fawn habitat, which is low brushy, you know, old field type habitat where you maybe burn every 2 or 3, 4 years in these old fields. That's great fawning habitat. Distributed that across your property, and you will not have as much sensitivity to predator populations.
That's interesting. Landy, you kept furrow in your brow. Did you have a question?
No, I'm just listening, taking it all in, man.
It's
every time, you know, the great thing about what we do is we never know, you know.
And it just gets more and more confusing.
Yeah, we're talking about the home ranges and everything.
You know, you make your habitat thicker, you make more bedding cover on your property. you're also making it harder to hunt your deer. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like it's all a double-edged sword in this management.
It's like we're all working towards this perfect balance.
Yeah. So we hear so many guys say, and we're trying to correct this thought process in hunters' minds, but a lot of them will say, well, if I don't kill this deer, my neighbor's going to kill it. And Hank Parker said it best on here. He said, hey, I can't control what my neighbor does, but I can control what I do. And if I don't kill him, he's going to survive another night, and maybe he'll survive the season. But I'm also hearing guys say, well, you know what, I'm going to let my neighbor shoot the does, and then I'm just going to let my place be quiet and the neighbor shoot the does. But I don't think that's the right thing to do either. Mm-hmm. And we got to.
Well, I think the bigger your place, the more responsibility you have too. Because, I mean, if a guy's only got 20 acres or whatever, he can probably have that attitude. But if you've got the bigger your place, then I think the more responsibility you have to adhere to. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
So how do we get to the point where a guy knows how many he needs to shoot on his property? I try to come back to that. Is it just shoot as many as you legally can?
Well, before I answer that, Bobby, I want to follow up so that somebody doesn't misunderstand my 30% rule from earlier. You know, that's a general rule that applies to a lot of places. But there are areas in Mississippi and all through the Southeast, and particularly in the lower coastal plain, where the soil quality is relatively low and the forage quality is relatively low because of past historical management. And you can't just go down there and start shooting a bunch of does and shoot 30% of the does every year and think you're going to do good, and eventually you'll end up with just fewer deer. And so we never say always, and we always say it depends. It depends on where you are and the habitat and the quality of the circumstances.
The carrying capacity.
Neighbors, you know, what they're doing, it really matters.
What I take from what he's telling us is that, it's really not a regional issue or a state issue as much as each individual local property owner, and it could be, you know, subregions, like parts of different parts of a county, whatever. But what I gather what he's telling me is that what's important is not that you try to be perfect about this and have a exact count and cut 30% back or whatever, is that you have a plan. You do the best you can with the available knowledge you have, listening to all the stuff we provide and others, but you have your own plan. And if your plan is, okay, I've made up my mind, we're going to kill 8, then go do it. Have a plan and do it. That's what's most important. Nobody's going to be perfect. And honestly, you know, it'd help you a lot to bring in some consultants and biologists. It would, but that's not going to be perfect either. Don't try to be perfect.
And you know what else could help is to communicate with your neighbors.
Absolutely.
You hear about the co-ops.
Yep.
Whatever you want to call it. But, you know, get to know your neighbors and be buddies with them and trade ideas and kind of meet as a group and discuss what you think you need to do as a whole.
Yeah, even in hunting clubs, it would be fun to collectively agree on a plan and then as a group execute it. Hey, you know what? We need to kill 20 does on the club this year. And
yeah,
you got together and you're working together and you're pulling together, y'all, you know, and you agree to that. And maybe some of the members don't like to shoot does, that's fine. But as a group, you've agreed to what you're going to do. And again, make a plan to the best of your ability, whatever that is. And then go do it and have a good time that year. Don't waste a year of your life mully grubbing over the privilege you get to go hunt and be a part of that. Just go have fun doing it.
I think it makes a lot of sense what y'all are talking about, you know, scheduling some time early in the season. You know, I shoot does every chance I get. So
early and often.
Early and often. Yes. That's right. And I know that's not necessarily the best way to do it. And it does have a drastic effect on rut hunting for me because, you know, it just does. So, scheduling some time, a dedicated weekend or two or three, and doing it every year. Like you're saying, I just reinforce what you're saying, Toxie. You know, plan your work your plan. Before you know it, 3 or 4 seasons are going to be going by, and you're going to see a drastic effect on what's going on in your place.
And, Bobby, back to your earlier question, how does a guy know? Well, monitoring the habitat is one of the ways we do this, letting the plants tell us, you know, what's there and how much pressure. We also use measurements on harvested deer, and we look at the condition of the animals. the first is looking at the condition of the habitat, and we also look at the condition of the animal population and let them tell us how good a diet they have. And we do that through body weights, antler measurements. We look at reproductive rates and lactation success and body weights of does. I love looking at yearling doe weights. It's a really good indicator because it's the youngest group of animals, and it's a relatively random sample. And it tells you what's happened in the last 2 years of the deer's life.
Another good reason to kill some does and some deer at the beginning of archery, even right there, because I've always, for all of my life, had deer in the worst condition around here then. Because even if you have a place in poor condition, they'll fatten up with it. We have a lot of oak trees and a lot of mast, and a lot of stuff comes on as fall progresses, at least. And you can get to Christmas and kill them, and they're in great, well, a lot better shape, and mm-hmm. it wouldn't actually tell you you've got a problem. So I've always paid attention a lot to the trail cam pictures I get in late summer, and the deer we harvest at the very beginning of archery is October 1st here. That tells me more than the deer we kill by the time Christmas or so rolls around. They're in a much better condition around here and much more body fat mm-hmm. than they are that late summer stress. And to say that's when deer are finishing out their antlers too. So, you know, if you're worried about that kind of quality, yeah. pay attention to what's going on with those trail cam pictures. And you can really say, I'm a, the state biologist, his name escapes me, always said, be sure to save not just your buck pictures when you go back to archive stuff, but save some up close daytime doe pictures of a bunch of different does and go back and look at them really close on your trail camera. That trail camera might be the best tool you have. And, you know, what kind of shape your deer are in.
It's interesting to in August to see those does, and they may have one or two babies, but they look poor.
Oh, they look terrible. And you can see it on trail cam pictures. And I know the properties we have that are totally timber properties and totally dependent on whatever we do with food plots, and then the ones that aren't. And you can see a dramatic difference in that late summer, first of bow season health.
Bobby, I'm going to jump in and give you a hard and fast general rule of thumb for how many does and should you be harvesting.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not as many as you should.
That's
exactly. I like this guy.
You know what? He is exactly, precisely, scientifically dead on. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, he is.
Especially here.
Is the best managed properties from a habitat standpoint and from a population standpoint with the right number of deer on the property, the best managed properties are the least fun to hunt on because you're not going to see any deer.
Mm-mm, not as many.
Very few.
Hmm. Absolutely. And guess what? Worst case scenario, you kill too many does. The worst thing that's going to happen is you're going to have a better rut the next year, and you're going to bounce back with healthier deer really, really quick. Conversely, if you go and don't kill enough deer and don't kill enough deer and don't kill enough deer, you're doing almost irreparable damage to your deer herd if you're and your habitat, you know, wiping out the stuff they need. So, yeah, err on the side. Yeah. If in doubt, you hadn't killed enough.
It's amazing how many deer we have now.
It is.
Absolutely.
They're just a great story of conservation, of how they...
Well, I hear stories from the state where they're worried about over-harvest or something in some places. But if our officials tell us in certain regions that we've over-harvested or whatever, maybe we should listen to them. But unless they pull the reins back, we need to be doing exactly what he's telling us right now.
So one thing I'd like to point out is I follow a couple of sites on Facebook, and you'll see where states are implementing apps and wanting you to tell what you harvested and whatnot, including our state here. And I'm seeing so many people saying, I'm not telling them. They don't need to. And that we don't need to behave like that. No. We need to provide as much information. So guys, really smart people like you and Bronson can analyze this data and help the state make the best decisions possible.
Absolutely. We are the research arm for our state wildlife agency. Mississippi mm-hmm. State is for Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. And actually a cooperative research project back in the late 70s actually developed the Deer Management Assistance Program here in Mississippi that you hear about throughout the Southeast and much of the North. The Deer Management Assistance Program started just down the road here at Mississippi State as a research project, and it is the most successful management tool for deer populations now.
Mac, you ought to hit the horns just for that.
No doubt about it.
That's a big deal.
That is a big deal. And let me tell
you what, Mac.
It's Christmas time, and when DMAP hit and you could get doe tags, that was like Christmas to me as a kid. I'm like, man, it's on.
Yeah, so I hear people talk all the time that covertly say, hey, they know everything I do now. Government knows where I'm at, and my, you know, they listen in on my family conversations and all. Right?
I don't say that.
I know, but I mean, I've had some eerie things happen, but I do know. I say that I don't know 100% anything, but I believe I've been told by the electronically advanced, and I'm challenged that if you're worried about them knowing where you are when you tag, you're supposed to not move a deer or a turkey now till you log it in. Then be sure to go through your settings and turn your location services off. And so I'm told by the technology people, nothing can trace your location if you turn that off. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but if you're worried about it, it's not a good excuse to not turn in the data. We need that data. We have to have it, and we can only. It's just like saying, I'm not going to vote. What does my one vote matter? Well, we all know how important that is.
Sure. Right.
So this is just as important as your vote right here. Yeah. And don't think you're not – plus, not to mention, it's illegal. So everybody needs to give them that data. It's an incredible tool that for the state.
And keep your own. Keep your own data.
That's one of the funnest things.
I have an iPhone that has notes. I'm kind of technologically – I have problems with that myself. Like, I'm not even good at spreadsheets.
You're good at singing, though, Dudley.
Exactly.
Yeah, no doubt.
But you can write it down. Put it by the skinning rack and write down the weights. Get a scale. Mm-hmm. They're cheap.
So let me ask this question. Y'all are making the best educated determination of what you think the state's population is, and then they set the limits or how many deer. Are y'all trying to harvest a certain percentage of that number?
If you have an estimate for a property, a specific number, then you can look at harvesting a percentage of it. Most properties don't know how many deer they have.
Well, I'm asking just generally about the state of Mississippi. You said earlier, y'all think there's 1.5 million, but you don't know exactly. And then when you get the harvest data that does come in, are you guys saying, oh, wait, we want to harvest 10%, or is there some kind of a number there?
No, the state doesn't work that way. They're not able to work that way because we still don't know how many deer are really harvested in the state of Mississippi. So what they do is they try to maximize the recreational opportunity for hunters. And I'm not a state biologist, but my understanding is they try to maximize recreational opportunities for hunters and management opportunity for the landowners. And together, if you're doing that, then and getting data, then you can manage your population effectively. If you don't want to do any part of that, then that's fine. But the state is all about helping you do what you want to do for your deer population.
Absolutely. I think he made a point. It's almost impossible to know how many deer you have on your place. I mean, unless you have a really small place, then it probably doesn't matter as much.
Sure.
So what I got from that also for people, so it kind of just makes sometimes too much data will also make people kind of give up because I don't know. How am I supposed to know, you know? So what I would say is, and that's what I would like to ask him too, is like, so let's just say it this way, and I like the way you generalize stuff. If you know, if you feel or you know you have more than you need or more than is healthy, then you just about can't shoot too many. That's the safe thing. So the question would be, what are some indicators? And he talked about a couple, but I want to go over one more time and list what his top indicators of I have too many is. Because instead of worried about, why do I do anything? I don't have the specific numbers. I can't keep up with that exactly. How do I know from trail camera pictures how many were the same deer? All that stuff. If you know your place, if you spend the time on it, you listen to the other people that hunt on it, you know if you have too many. You'll know that. But what are those indicators? And again, if you have those indicators, you have these things happening, you just about can't take too many miles off of it. So what are those main indicators people will look for with everything we've talked about?
So body weights are really important, but you can't just have a clump of body weights. You have to know the age of the deer because, you know, I weigh a little bit more now at my mature age.
You need to keep data from the past years too. So you
absolutely,
you know,
and that's the key. With oftentimes we don't have ever have enough data from a particular property, but you monitor trends in the data.
Absolutely,
you might have just half a dozen body weights on yearling does, like I was talking about, but keep that value and monitor it over many years, and you look for the general pattern. Is it going up, meaning things are getting better, or is it going down? And if it's going down, then you're not doing something, and you need to fix whatever you're not doing.
Yeah. Could you have I just thought of one that I think people could use as part of the equation is your sightings, and I realize bucks don't always show themselves, but if your sightings of number of does versus bucks, and especially your trail cam pictures, I mean, what's a healthy number? If you're seeing, you know, if you're paying attention to when people hunt or you're paying attention to trail cameras and you do the best you can, I know it's not exact science, and you feel like you've got about 5 or 8 does per buck, you know, regardless of the overall population, you need to harvest a bunch of does.
Sure.
Right? So what's that number would be healthy? I mean, I know there's, I mean, even 1-to-1 might be, but would you say 2-to-1 is a...
Well, the sex ratio you want to target is totally dependent on your management goals.
Right.
And if you're in a, you know, a trophy management type program, a 1-to-1 is the kind of classic sex ratio.
So that could give you a target to shoot for and harvest even without population data, just by... You know, how many bucks per doe you're keeping up with.
Yeah, and you know, you don't want to base that on harvest because that harvest is going to be susceptible to biases.
Right.
But if you use your early archery season, archery hunters are tend to be some of the better, I don't know if I want to say better hunters, but they're...
They're
more observant, and they're closer to the deer by the nature of the beast. Yeah. And so they're seeing does and fawns and bucks prior to the big, heavy gun hunting activity, so the deer haven't responded as much. So you have a much more valid estimate of sex ratio and fawn recruitment early in the hunting season, before the does are starting the fawns are going to get off the does and they're going to dry up. So a late hunting season doe, we don't care whether she was lactating or not. We don't use the data past early December.
Hmm.
Because they're going to naturally be weaning.
Yeah.
Right.
What about some observational stuff? We use exclusion cages in our food plots.
Yep.
That could be a good
indicator
of health. If you're planting something that's typically not the most preferred, so in the case of brassicas, turnips are probably the least preferred out of them. If you plant a field of turnips and they're eating them down before November hits, then you probably
got a pretty high deer density.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add, if someone's going to go buy a utilization cage, they should try to put, unless they only have one field.
Yeah, I guess.
But they should diversify it out to several of their fields and different soils, different stuff they planted to get a feel for it. Because if you just put it on your one most lush field, that may be what they're hammering. It might not have grown as good. But that could be really – that's pretty telling. Mm. In fact, it's actually shocking sometimes.
You know, it was interesting to me. Early in this conversation, you mentioned that a lot of the most preferred native browse you don't even see anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, some of that – if there's a way to reestablish that on a property in a cage so that at least you're giving that property a chance
to be a big cage in a lot of cages, though. It's, you know, you just got to get return for your effort. You know, that's why we had these conversations about these in the right place in the right condition, these burns. You know, disturbing soils. If I'm not mistaken, some of these plants can lay or seed or part of a root can lay in the soil for 2, 5, 10 years.
Absolutely.
And be disturbed and brought back to life. So, you know, that's another thing we could do is, you know, we talked about it some.
Sure.
Disturbing the soil, control burns, you know.
I love how folks are starting to learn more about you don't have to burn only in February every year.
Absolutely.
You know, that's
Marcus, how do you say his last
name?
Yeah, I mean, he's on a mission to teach that.
Dr. Disturbance.
Yeah.
It's a great name.
Yeah. I follow him. I enjoy – he's got some great stuff. And I follow you guys. Y'all put out some great stuff. So, you know, and I want to make sure before I forget, though, but if you're a young person – and you're thinking about going to college and studying wildlife.
You need to be a bulldog.
Yes, correct.
The state has got some good stuff going on. You guys.
Come on, Mac.
I just.
Time to be a bulldog.
Always hear good things about what's going on over there.
We appreciate that, Bobby. Thank you.
It's a heck of a resource for us, too. I'll tell you that right now.
And Lanny's over at those deer pens all the time with
his the best.
Nose mashed up against the fence.
The first place I went in Starkville, Mississippi was the deer pens.
So I'm prejudiced. And it's absolutely the place. And if you are thinking about that, but I'm admittedly biased. I mean, my mom, my dad, everybody in my family went to state. But I'll also use the Joe Namath. I know you're not an Alabama fan, but I'll use the Joe Namath rule. He made it famous by saying, he said, hey, if it's true, you ain't bragging.
So, did Joe Namath play?
You know, it's true.
I'm not sure who Joe
Namath is. It's really, really true. And not only the curriculum available and the quality of it, but the culture over there.
The culture is
on. Yeah, it's because it's such a big part of what makes Mississippi State special. I know we got great schools, you know, architecture, engineering, you go on and on about some of the stuff over there, but it is such a big part of the culture and the pride in our university. And I think that actually makes a big difference in what you get over there in getting education.
Golly, just ride over there. My goodness.
Yes, absolutely positively.
Yeah. I like it because they plant a bunch of cool oaks all over campus.
Yes,
that's well, my favorite. All they have to do is Google and learn a little bit about Dr. Damaris. Yeah. And
MSUDeerLab.com.
Bronson Strickland. And, you guys, it's just impressive.
And Bobby, I want to jump back. You're talking about exclusion cages outside of the food plot. It's a difficult tool to do it that way for a property management or a large area, but you can learn a lot about your forages and what the deer really like by putting up a 10 by 10 foot square fence and just seeing what grows in there that doesn't grow outside of it.
Okay, well, let me explain what I was thinking, and y'all tell me if I'm wrong. So if a guy took an area the size of this table and fenced it off and put some strawberry bushes
and let the deer eat what grows outside of it.
But then, so the birds might disperse those seeds and the property might have a chance to have some more.
True. Good idea. I don't know, but you got to have a seed that'll do that and know. But, yeah, theoretically, absolutely.
People caged greenbrier before, hadn't they?
And then that's why you got to do
Japanese honeysuckle.
That's a whole other study in business for us because you want to think what are plants that you could reintroduce that could be browsed heavily and survive. That's what you want, not just the best nutrition because if you get a little strawberry bush going again and they wipe it out, what good have you done? So what could you reintroduce in that manner, Bobby? That's brilliant thinking. But what would you want to do? What plant would you – I turn to him in Mississippi State and say, what plant would you like it to be? And that's what we should try to figure out how to do and encourage.
What would I say, Lanny?
It depends.
He wouldn't say kudzu, though.
I bet we could get a couple of varieties out of them.
Oh, maybe.
Just well, look, a quick little story about why it depends.
It's irrelevant.
In the upper coastal plain, maple, red maple, is not a preferred forage at all. But in a lower coastal plain, it's a highly preferred forage.
Yep.
Because down there, it's some of the best stuff that the deer could find. Up here, it's you know, run-of-the-mill hamburger.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Toxie, what were you saying a few months ago? Something about a deer's brain and stomach is more connected than
stomach. I don't believe that was me.
Well,
I was talking about Vandy's brain and stomach being more connected.
It's just so interesting how their body can tell them what they need.
No, that's true.
Better than a human's brain.
I yield to him, but yeah, they're. You know,
I just want to go eat. Cheeseburgers from McDonald's, but a deer's brain actually tells them you need to eat more of this.
Your brain does too. You just won't let it listen.
I mean, they want something they can digest, obviously, and utilize.
Well, we've always thought they're selective browsers. Yeah, I've always slaves to their stomach.
Listened to biologists saying that, you know, they crave what they're deficient in.
I guess
they have nutritional wisdom.
Ah,
okay. That's the phrase.
Term there. Nutritional wisdom. And some of the things you hear about, well, a food plot planting doesn't work in my area, whereas it does in another. Well, we've documented from our research that deer will select what they need, and if the plant, if the property has a lot of a particular mineral, they're going to avoid that mineral in the food plot. But if the property doesn't have a lot of that particular mineral and it's rich in a particular forage, then they're going to hammer it on the food plot. Huh. So those deer are going to be making those decisions, not generally white-tailed deer do this, and that they do, they have tendencies, but what do they need on that particular property?
It goes back to what Toxie said earlier. Nature is so amazing.
Yeah. You know, the wonder. It never, you have a podcast, and you have someone like him that's so valuable to have on, and you just feel like going into the podcast that we're going to knock out all this stuff. We're going to learn so much. We're going to really put our arms around.
This stuff
we're
going
to put a fence around all this and have it figured out. And, you know, in his wisdom and in our rambling, we realize.
It depends.
Yeah, it does depend. And that's kind of the fun part of it, because in living a life as a gamekeeper, it's never, you're never done, ever. No matter how much work you've done, no matter what you've learned, no matter what's going on. And don't get frustrated with not getting there. My place isn't quite where I want it to be. Don't be frustrated. Be overjoyed at the work and living a life as a gamekeeper, getting to do that kind of work, getting, you know, caring about your place, keeping up with the data, mm-hmm. harvesting the does, eating the meat, all these things that fit together, you know, it's because we'll never get there and have it perfectly. But the point he's making, I believe, is to get everybody and get more and more people engaged in trying to get there. Mm-hmm. That's the point.
Yeah. That's the point.
Wow. Good times.
Well, gosh, this has been really good.
Let's go shoot some does.
Yeah. we do need
and to. Some bucks.
Yeah, here you go.
Yes, sir. Well, so, Mac, do you have a question? This podcast was Mac's idea, so I want to make sure he has a chance
blame
to.
Mac.
Producer man over there. Oh, he's getting his notes out.
I do have one question.
He's texting over there.
Yeah. I've got a random question myself, and this is kind of off topic.
Random's my middle name.
I wanted to hear Steve's answer. Me and my buddies always talk about this scenario. Like, okay, say you're hunting over a big field one afternoon, and shooting time comes. You didn't shoot a deer, and you don't want to get out of your stand and scare all your deer away.
Oh, yeah.
What do you do? Do you just get out of the stand and run the deer off? Do you make some kind of weird noise like a dog or what?
Man, that's a brilliant question, Dudley. I have no idea.
You don't?
What?
You could play Dudley's Christmas Carol.
definitely run from that.
I've got buddies that'll bark like a dog. I've got I usually throw a snort wheeze, and it usually kind of makes them pick their head up, and a lot of them will just kind of.
Could you give us a sample of
that? Yeah, let's hit a snort wheeze.
You want me to give you my snort wheeze?
Oh,
All right. Something like that.
Something like that
runs around.
What happened to the snort? That was just a wheeze.
Whatever.
That was good, Dudley. Seriously, you know, you don't want to train them that you're there, but there's no way they're not going to know that you're getting out of that stand and then walking out. I mean, they're going to know you're there, but the point is minimize your impact and don't go to the same stand day after day after day and wonder why you're not seeing
That's probably the right answer. Mm-hmm. Quit hunting big fields so much.
A lot of people that I know have a buddy, and that buddy will come pick them up, and then they'll go pick up another, and try to run the deer out of the field.
So if the deer are used to a vehicle, vehicles and stuff, that's a good method.
If they're not used to a vehicle, you're just as
that's true.
One thing I've learned over here, what spooks deer worse than seeing you is smelling you. So
it depends.
There's nothing that will spook them human odor left laying around or whatever. So I'd go back to not trying to shoot my does, because then you shot one, there's a big pile of blood, you're out there for 30 minutes after dark dragging it out and doing all that, maybe looking for it, stomping around. I would avoid that if you're worried about a certain place being for a trophy deer.
So Mac decided he doesn't have a question. But we kind of start wrapping up, and then we do an Ask Dudley.
We got one today?
We've got one. Dr. Steve, I'd love for you to stay with us, please, if you would.
To make sure Dudley's giving
but
the correct
before
answer.
We leave this topic, there's one thing I wanted to say to guys, that we're talking about killing a lot of deer, And I see where people sometimes throw carcasses in creeks, and we don't need to do that. And I want to – Lowndes County, Mississippi has dumpsters all over the county where you can throw a deer carcass in. I don't know why more counties don't do that. It seems like a brilliant idea. But so I just wanted to remind folks, hey, don't go throw it off a bridge in the right. middle of the night, and because right. that's just creating all kind of problems. So I'm off my little soapbox there, but so
thank you, Mr. Know-it-all.
Yeah. Do we have a back? Would you please?
Hey, Dudley. How does an acorn crop on white oaks this year affect next year's crop? Are the acorns on a tree the same size each year? This year, I've been on a property in the river swamp and found white oaks with acorns the size of golf balls. If I plant them, will the tree grow to have the same size acorns? Thanks, Dovezar.
Okay, so that's
the
Vandy. Vandy Collins.
That's a great question,
yeah,
too.
And let me just say, right now while we're doing this, he's having heart surgery.
Oh. Well,
so this is – he had asked that question, and this gives him something to look forward to. As soon as he gets out of heart surgery, he'll be able to hear this next week.
Well, Vandy, we love you, and this is kind of a tricky question because it's like three questions in one.
It depends.
But,
yep.
yeah. And this is going to be, you know, just from some of my non-scientific observation.
Observational data, yeah.
Because I do see a lot of acorns every year. How does the acorn crop on white oaks this year affect next year's crop? You know, that's to me, that's really cyclical. There's individual oaks that drop more than others. But I think he's kind of talking about like a bumper year where they're all good. So usually when they have a really good year, the next year isn't that great. You know, so that answers that. Are the acorns on a tree the same size each year? Again, individual trees. I'm thinking swamp white oak swamp chestnut oak, because he mentioned a river bottom and white oaks. I've seen swamp chestnut oaks individuals that have very small acorns.
Yep.
I've seen individual trees that have very large acorns. But on a year like this year where we had so much rainfall, yes, they on average will be a little bit larger than normal.
But you would also agree there is a fair amount of genetics involved in that acorn size, too.
Absolutely. That's just like tomatoes.
That's right.
You know,
exactly.
A better boy tomato on a really good year, it'll have slightly bigger tomatoes.
I found the one hybrid that has it's bigger than a guy. They're just gigantic acorns. And even if that tree has 3 acorns, they're gigantic. If it has a bumper crop, they're gigantic. So, you know, that's genetics.
Yep. Let's see, if I plant them, will they grow into the same size acorns? And that one, these are open pollinated trees. You don't know what the other parent is because it was windblown pollen, tree sperm that just flew through the air and landed on that female flower. So no, you know what half of the genetics is.
So you say you have a better chance.
Probably so.
But not anything certain at all.
Not even close. Right. Not unless it's in a controlled environment, you know, where you're and they call it true to type.
Right.
They don't really come back true to type every time, but you are definitely increasing the chance. So that's it.
Yeah, good.
Great stuff. That's
a great question. And Vandy, we hope you're getting well. Sure.
That's
do.
Right.
So, look, I'm going to look around the room. What did we learn today? I know that we learned so much.
You never know it all. You know, I mean, this
and it depends.
We learned that.
It depends. That's right.
I learned Dudley cannot sing. Yeah. Right off the bat, I learned
that. My feelings are hurt.
I thought he sang pretty good. Of course, I'm not.
I did too, honestly. Yeah. Well, I learned that he could sing.
Well, yeah,
we don't have a Bobby Dudley duet or anything.
Not I don't expect
I owe all that to my high school choir instructor, Robert E. Lee from Jackson Preparatory School. 1994.
Okay, I'm not going to say anything as much as I would like to. We're going to wrap this one up. Dr. Demarest, we appreciate you being here. We thank so much of you and Dr. Bronson Strickland. Y'all are always so helpful to us. We love having y'all over here. And guys can go listen to your podcast. It's called Deer University.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yep. Good stuff.
I learned that you can never quit learning.
That's right.
And the smartest, again, I'm probably the smartest deer university in the country. Okay, there's probably some others close to them, but not to get in that argument. But as smart as they are, they're continuing to learn all the time too. Mm-hmm. And so let's never stop learning, no matter how much you know.
Name it a game.
Yep. Amen to that.
Absolutely.
Name it a game.
All right, Mac, are we good as far as you? I got a thumbs up. We got Jack, the intern.
Is he back? Did he make it back? Jack.
Wake up, Jack.
He's
so,
there.
All right, he's there. So won't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Mac.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife Magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt Podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.